This is an ABC podcast.
Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
Hello, and get the one talk. Good morning, and Manuia Letsayao. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Eki Tupong, and on the show today, the patrol boat RVS Takuare has reportedly run aground off Epi Island. Will PNG benefit from the recently signed Pukpuk Treaty with Australia?
The construct of this treaty is a construct in peacetime for peace. This is not a construct to create war.
And victims of tribal violence in PNG are calling for better security and help.
Our government should support, but they are very stubborn people. They are not supporting their people.
More on those stories shortly, but as always, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, known as Melbourne. I say tengkiuturu, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has defended the signing of a new defence treaty with Australia. Prime Minister James Marape says PNG will benefit from the Pukpuk Treaty, which commits both countries to come to each other's aid in the face of common danger. But Mr. Marape told the ABC's Sarah Ferguson that in the event of a conflict between China and Australia, his country can opt to sit out.
It's a natural progress from where we have come from. 2 years after independence in 1977, we signed a status of force agreement. Lately, in 2013, we signed a defence cooperation agreement. And a defence treaty is just a natural progression from where we've come from, bearing that we have many things in similarity than the differences. So a natural progression from where we've started.
As many as 10,000 PNG troops could be incorporated into the Australian Army. Could it be even more than that 10,000 number?
It's a subject to the working of the treaty. If Australia needs personnel to be recruited, Papua New Guinea has a youthful population. Most of them complete grade 12 and subject to the due processes. Papua New Guineans can be enlisted into Australian Defence Force. They will not be reporting to the PNG Defence Force Commander. They will be Australian Defence Force personnel. Of course, in PNG ourselves, it is in our interest to build a Defence Force to a 7,000-man force that is strong in our land, sea and air capacities.
Did Chinese officials make any direct or indirect threats as to the consequences if you signed this treaty with Australia?
Not at all, and I want to commend Chinese who gave us full respect to our sovereign interests, and they understand very clearly where we've come from. In 1975, prior to September 16, we were part of the Australian sovereignty. Our shared history speaks volume, and so they clearly understand where we are going, and we've been transparent to not just Chinese, but all nations we have foreign relationship with or security relationship with.
Now, this agreement clearly serves Australia's military interests that, as we know, are explicitly focused on the threat from China. How does that serve PNG's interests?
PNG's interests come in the range of spin-offs that comes under the umbrella of this treaty. Not just the hands and boots and uniforms conversation, but the military hardwares, the military softwares. So there's a range of benefits that PNG Defence Force gets as a result of this.
But presumably, Prime Minister, you could get all of those benefits from the defence arrangements that you already had. This treaty is different because it commits you to act in the face of a common danger. That's the question. That's clearly in Australia's interest because PNG provides a useful geographic location as well as all the other benefits. But what does PNG get from Australia's interests vis-à-vis a heavily militarising China?
As I said earlier, PNG stands beneficial to the capacity built of our own defence force. The construct of this treaty is a construct in peacetime for peace. This is not a construct to create war. It is rather a construct to establish peace.
And yet, at the same time, the Australian Defence Review, Strategic Review, recently made absolutely clear and explicit that it was being put together with an eye to the rapid militarisation of the Chinese military. Do you see the militarisation of China in the same way as Australia does?
It's a nation, whether it's Australia or China or any nation for that matter, have their own strategic views in terms of their military. And it's entirely up to China or Australia to build up their defence force.
Except that now you're involved in a mutual defence treaty where you would join Australia if it came under attack.
There is a provision in the agreement that whenever attacks does take place, if it does happen, and there is ability for PNG Defence Force Commander and Australia Defence Force Commander to engage in making critical military decisions at that point in time.
So you are not actually necessarily committing to join a conflict with China that Australia was involved in?
What does PNG have to offer right now? As a question, I would be letting my country know. At the moment, our military capacity is not at a space where we are active participant. We are contributor to subject conflict, and so it is in our interest to work to build. And I don't necessarily see China as an enemy. China is a good relationship nation, even with Australia, with PNG. We trade with China. We do business with China. And so there's no need for an alarmist approach in this conversation.
But if it's a realistic question as opposed to an alarmist one, obviously the Australian Defence Force, the Australian Defence Establishment has considered the possibility of war with China. We know the Americans have considered that possibility. So what does PNG do in those circumstances?
I don't have the mindset of Australian Defence Force to speak for the Australian Defence Force.
But the question is actually what PNG would do in those circumstances. Let me put it like this, Prime Minister. Is it possible that PNG could make a decision not to be involved in a conflict Australia was engaged in with China?
There's a high possibility when that event happens. PNG has a sovereign in itself. This construct of treaty was constructed within the fullest ambit of respecting sovereignties in making their own calls.
So if you sign a treaty that talks about facing a common danger, what a common danger is?
Likewise, Australia, PNG was engaged in a construct. We would not expect in a conflict. We don't expect Australia to drop everything else and run to us. The treaty has provisions where there'll be consultations, there'll be engaged. There's a finality of making call that rests with respective Defence Force commanders.
And that is Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, James Marape, speaking there to ABC's Sarah Ferguson. Well, for a deeper look into the Puk Puk Treaty, we're joined by Oliver Nobendal, Research Fellow and the Project Director of the Australia Papua New Guinea Network at the Lowy Institute. That I say good morning, Oliver. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Stuart Agi, and I apologise, my voice is a little bit scratchy. I was celebrating at the grand final on Sunday.
It's all right. I'll let you off for this morning. No worries. Well, Oliver, look, the signing ceremony, right, it's been done, and the details of the agreement have now been made available. I mean, were there any surprises, though, that came out in the body of the text?
In the body of the text, not so much. I mean, looking through it, a lot of it is what we had expected, and I think we can look at the main elements. Firstly, looking at the purpose of this agreement, it's quite broad, and there's a lot of references reaffirming the commitment to the sovereignty of each party. So it's unsurprising that Marape's position would be that there is no automatic call into action by either party should one of these, either Australia or Papua New Guinea, face a threat, and they're putting a lot more emphasis in the consultation. The other big element to note as well is sort of the how they've described mutual defence, talking about maintaining and developing their individual capacities to protect sovereignty, and declares, while it, in the text it does say that it would declare to meet common danger, it says that this is going to be done through constitutional processes. And obviously the other one as well, which I think seems to have been watered down, was that there's a big expectation on the recruitment part, but this seems to have been provided for in sort of a sub-paragraph within Article 5. But this, I think it's also worth noting that there's references to implementation agreements. So what we can expect is that a lot of these elements will be fleshed out sort of at the technical levels.
Right. Okay. Well, if we're looking at the next steps, it would be the ratification of the Puk Puk Treaty, right? So what does that look like for PNG? And is there likely to be challenges in getting the treaty ratified by PNG's parliament?
Yeah, look, I think when the joint communique was signed, like around 3 weeks ago now, I think it was quite telling, right? And it was a really good opportunity to get a sense check of what the concerns were or what we could possibly expect when this does go to parliament. Now, there were two main first, I'll sort of talk about those concerns in the process. Oh, I'm sorry. No, let me just talk about the process now. So the process that PNG will have to follow is that the signing has to take place first, which sort of initiates the treaty ratification process. Now, what will happen next is that this text will be taken to the floor of the PNG parliament, where it will be debated, and then it will be ratified by the parliament should they decide to accept it. It's important to note that usually what would happen is that if there is no domestic law which gives effect to the provisions of the treaty, the new law will have to be created. Only then does the treaty actually legally enter into force. However, the statement that was provided by Prime Minister Marabit is that no laws will be changed. Now, what we can take from that is that there is already a sufficient legal basis for this to take place within PNG, so that only what is needed is that parliamentary approval. So what can we expect when we go there? I think we were quite shocked to see, or not shocked, but I think it was surprising to see the level of outcry from the public. And while they are valid concerns, this is really up to the government now to try and put those at bay. The two main concerns that we would have seen, the main challenges are, what does this mean for sovereignty? And I think that's a reflection of why there are so many references to sovereignty within the text of the agreement and how that's going to be protected, and not putting sort of compulsory obligations, I guess if that's a way to describe it, on either party to act in the face of a common danger. And the other question is on what this means with the relationship with China. Now, there's a lot of support that China has on the ground, I guess, in terms of the relationship and what it can offer in terms of economic development and partnerships. And a lot of the citizens are concerned whether or not this is going to chase China away. Now, in 7:30 last night, with the interview that Prime Minister Marape had, he had stated that China had been quite respectful of the treaty process in this negotiation and not and tried not to get involved. This is sort of a different view than when China had released its the Chinese embassy in Port Moresby had released a statement after the signing of the joint communique, saying that the treaty should not unfairly really affect third party interests in PNG. And if we go through the text, you see that the what I'm taking from the text is that the provisions in there are not exclusionary. What it does is it sort of elevates this relationship between Australia and PNG to a really high level, where all other third-party engagements are allowed as long as they don't prevent either Australia or PNG from carrying out its obligations under the treaty. So that's sort of what we can expect when this goes to Parliament and more public debate happens.
Well, Oliver, yesterday what was interesting, PNG Prime Minister James Marape went to really great lengths to speak about this treaty as a multi-generational initiative and how it would go beyond his lifetime and even Albanese's lifetime. You know, he used quite emotive language to portray it, I suppose, as something bigger than a political agreement. I mean, what did you make of his tone and messaging?
Yeah, look, I think what I took away from it, I think, look, it's correct. We don't necessarily change things a lot as they relate to international obligations. There's a lot of things that change domestically when new governments come in, for instance, policies and medium-term plans. But internationally, it's very rare that a new government could possibly come in and terminate any sort of international agreements that we have. Most of them just build off of the foundations that are set by former governments. And I think what this means for PNG as well, I think Marape has sort of turned his thinking to more legacy questions now for himself. You know, it's not just about what he can deliver in the short term, medium term for his sort of domestic constituents, but I think he's really thinking about what is the legacy that he has to leave behind. And look, I agree that this is, you know, the wording that was stated in terms of this is like a natural progression of the relationship. And what we have seen now, I guess, in the geopolitical environment has sort of just brought that natural progression to occur a lot faster in terms of signing of a treaty. And look, I think it's I would have to give credit to MARPA as well. I think it's good to be thinking long term about this and thinking about things that can be implemented by other governments and not just by himself.
Okay, well, Mr. Marape took a question also from Australian media about what happens if there's problems in Bougainville. Now, he said that Bougainville would be a demilitarised zone. I mean, then why is it important that Bougainville is factored into, you know, the Puk Puk Treaty?
Yeah, look, I think it's a little bit, I think when this was being negotiated, I think Bougainville was really in the minds of a lot of the negotiators. And primarily to address the concerns that, you know, we won't be, you know, because a lot of the security issues that PNG faces are internal, and there are concerns that does this mean that when the PNG Defense Forces, for instance, deployed to assist the PNG police on curbing a lot more of these internal conflicts, does that mean that the Australian Defense Forces will get involved? I don't think that's the case. And really, historically, what this lies on is the experience at Bougainville, where Australia themselves, and they're quite cognizant of this, they were heavily criticized for really sort of funding the crisis that happened, where they were providing budget support, the provision of two Iroquois helicopters as well to the PNG Defense Force. And essentially what these resources were used was on the conflict in Bougainville. So I think this is fresh in the minds of both of these governments. And then this is why this has to be mentioned as well. But also noting the particular case of Bougainville as well, knowing its intentions right now to achieve independence as well, I think it warranted a sort of reference.
Oliver, if we could just answer this in two parts, do you think Papua New Guineans will welcome this deal? Because the other thing is, what happens if people or Papua New Guineans start to raise their concerns about certain parts of the treaty? Is there an avenue to make changes to the treaty?
Yeah, okay. So I guess I can answer the second part first, right? So I think what people can be comfortable with is that there is an amendment clause within the treaty. And it's I think, what has to be known for the Papua New Guinean citizens as well is how they can be involved in this sort of decision-making process. And really, that's through their elected members. And it's for them to advocate to their members that there are certain parts of the treaty that they don't feel comfortable about. But there is an amendment provision in place within the treaty that allows for these amendments to be made. And I think the first question you asked was, will they be welcoming to the treaty? Is that
yes,
what you said?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, look, so right now it's a little bit difficult for me to tell. I think anecdotally, it seems to be a 50-50 split. Now, I think whenever the question of sovereignty arises, Papua New Guineans are definitely on guard, and they want to really scrutinize this. And I think that when they get the chance to look at the treaty, there may be a lot of these concerns may be put at bay. Whether or not they welcome it, I think they will, because I think, frankly speaking, this is something that will concern more military personnel. And unless this is something that infringes on a Papua New Guinean citizen's really personal life, I don't think that this is something that they would really actively go against. In that case, I think it will be welcoming based on the fact that it's going to, while it will sort of benefit the broader population, it will directly benefit the lives of really a few people, which is those who are engaged in the military activities.
Oliver, that is all the time we have for this morning, but really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for always making the time.
No worries. Look after your voice, okay?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Maggie.
That is Oliver Nobenthal, a research fellow and project director of the Australia Papua New Guinea Network at the Lowy Institute. 15 to 11, Lover, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. We head to Solomon Islands, where the Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele, is confident he has the numbers to stave off any possible no-confidence vote. Political speculation has been rife in Honiara, with the Solomon Star newspaper reporting that a motion of no-confidence against the Prime Minister is imminent, with Parliament resuming next week. Clerk to the Parliament, Jefferson Halu, has confirmed to the ABC that as of close of business yesterday, there's been no notice for a motion. But already, the Prime Minister has reshuffled his cabinet, appointing the third finance minister in under a month. But the Prime Minister told a press conference that his reshuffle was based on a single objective, stability.
By stability, I mean long-term political and operational stability, the kind that allows the Government for National Unity and Transformation to serve its full mandate under the 12th Parliament. As a country, we have seen how frequent changes of government can disrupt policy continuity and progress. My duty as Prime Minister is to safeguard stability so that JINAT can complete its work and deliver tangible results for our people. Cabinet reshuffles are not a sign of weakness. They are a normal part of governance. Even as ministers change, ministries continue to function fully. All programs and services remain uninterrupted, and leadership requires making adjustments where necessary to strengthen performance and unity within the government. As Prime Minister, I remain fully focused on the national interest and will continue to make decisions that keep our government stable, steady, and our country moving forward.
And since taking up power last year, Prime Minister Manele has defeated multiple attempts to oust him through to no confidence votes. He says motions of no confidence are serious impediments to any country's growth.
Motions of no confidence without any strong basis for it, we are basically sort of getting the country moving backwards instead of going forwards. Because every time there is a motion of no confidence, we are keeping the country 1 or 2 months in suspense. And if the motion gets through, then another 1 month or so more for new government for him coming. I'm not saying that motions of no confidence should not be moved against the current government. I'm just saying the implications of motions of no confidence vis-a-vis the importance of stability for us as a country. I think that stability is important, I'm all saying. But I'm prepared. I'm prepared to face any motions of no confidence.
And that is Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele speaking at a press conference in Honiara.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me taki ma'atha. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aki Tupong, and we go to Vanuatu now, where the patrol boat RVS Tokuare has reportedly run aground off Epi Island. The vessel, which had just returned to Vanuatu following extensive repairs in Australia, was on a ministerial tour when it ran aground. A gift from Australia in 2021, the vessel was damaged by Cyclone Kevin in 2023 and was only returned to service 8 months ago. Joining us this morning is ABC's Leah Lonbu, who has more. Good morning, Leah.
Good morning, Aggie.
What's the latest you can report from the RVS Tokuare incident? Like, do we know how badly the vessel is damaged and whether there are any injuries among the crew?
So, from what information we've collected, we understand that the patrol boat is still grounded on the reef on south of Epi Island and is expected to be assisted by two other boats from the Police Maritime Wing. There's still no information about any major damages or any incident with the crew. When we spoke to the Director General of the Department of Internal Affairs, Lead Ferumaito, who is part of the ministerial delegation who were transported by the RVS Tokuare on Sunday night to South Epi Island. Before that incident happened. So we will be getting more updates today.
Okay. But Leah, do you have any information on what actually may have caused the grounding?
So according to the DG Lead Ferumaito, on Sunday night after the delegation were dropped off on South Epi, the patrol boat drifted off the port and onto the reef. We do have confirmation that the crew were on board when the incident happened, but there is no clear information yet about what technical issue were faced. DG Ferumaito says that they will release the detail information about the incident.
Are we aware, you know, with the area where the vessel ran aground, is it a problematic area for ships?
No, we haven't got any information on that. I think it might be the first time that an incident like this has happened in that area.
Okay. Well, Leah, we know that the RVS Takoare has had a bit of a troubled past. I mean, can you take us through some of the mishaps that have fallen on the vessel?
Yes. So there has been a few technical issues that has happened to the Batchel boat donated by the Australian government back in 2021. And you have shared the most recent situation in 2023 with Cyclone Kevin, where it went through major damages during that time. And repairs were made in Australia and was returned to Vanuatu in March this year, 2025.
Okay. Well, moving forward then, Leah, are you aware of what the response plan may be from Vanuatu authorities with the ship?
Yes. So, again, the Police Maritime Wing is currently responding to the situation. Two boats are on their way. One of them is another boat donated by the Australian government called the RVS Sokomanu. They will be assisting to remove the boat from the reef, and then RVS Sokomanu will be assisting the government for the rest of their tour to other islands. So, yeah, that's the current information that we have at the moment. There will be investigation about the damages, if there's any major damages, and a report will be released.
Of course. All right. Well, we will definitely be keeping our eyes and ears peeled for that information once it's updated. But again, thank you very much, Leah, for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Well, that is ABC's Leah Loanbu joining us here on Pacific Beat. And as you would have heard, we did just speak about the patrol boat RVS Takoare reportedly running aground off Epi Island. We've also discussed the signing of a new defence treaty between Australia and PNG. But coming up, there is concerns around the growing number of teenage pregnancies in Fiji, and victims of tribal violence in PNG are calling for better security and help. Those stories and more right here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Malo tau mae bombongini, this is Pacific Beat. Well, as Papua New Guinea signed off on a new landmark defence treaty with Australia, in PNG's Highlands region, victims of tribal violence are calling for better security and help. One community group, the Lagaip of Poverty Relivers Association, has stepped forward to provide a path forward for those displaced and traumatised by violence. The group's founder, Tony Sulupin, explained to the ABC's Godwin Eki about the skills they're trying to pass on to young people.
We are trying to involve them and try to raise some income. We pay them little income that sustain their livelihood. So, yeah, most of the people we engage in our project are from the tribal fight affected areas. So we try to provide some case handling opportunities for them to support their livelihood.
And I understand you're doing some construction work, building a center for. Can you explain to us what the center is for?
It's a community cultural resource and a building project, level 3 building. It received funding from German embassy, and also we are supported by the National Cultural Commission. The building construction is going on. After completion of this project, we will provide a community-based life skills training to our women to make local food, feed for the animals, and also climate change training, agriculture farming training, and a number of trainings that we are trying to offer to our community in partnership with our development partners like National Agriculture Research Institute, Fresh Produce Development Agency, and our development international partners like UNDP, Red Cross, things like that. This year, July, we have trained 45 women from within the community. We train them. We train them out to make a tree nursery, and actually they have taken the initiative to raise about 5,000 tree nursery seedlings. Some of those tree seedlings we have planted in the field, and some are still in the nursery. So we are engaging 45 women to combat climate change and reforestation initiative.
And you also have men who have also been affected by, you know, tribal fights in the area. I believe you're probably doing something with them, especially things like carpentry and other activities that they're involved in the program.
Yeah, men, most of the men are prone to get killed in the tribal fight. So what I'm doing is I am engaging most of the young boys in this construction. Even though tribal fight is going on, but I am keeping them busy in this construction, so they are on the safe side. And at the same time, we provide some sort of income for them to support their livelihoods.
How many people have you engaged into doing certain activities?
So actually, in the group, there's 100 registered women. And then we have around 15 registered men. They are the core members of the association. And due to a funding problem, and our activities are not fully funded, it's like a voluntary activity. So whenever there is project coming up or there is little activity needs to be done, then it's voluntary. So we just call for our people to come and take part, and they do their work. And at the end, we provide some kind of incentive for them. It's basically, it's like a volunteer.
What can you tell us about the young kids or, you know, young girls and young men that have been affected by the tribal fights?
I think a couple of weeks ago, there was a tribal fight within our community, and two of our students were killed. They were murdered by some thug. The two students from our community high school, they were killed, and then it full-scale warfare, and then it lasted for 1 week. Students were also taking part in tribal fight, I should say. Two of our students were killed, and it's a sad story for us.
How long can you be doing this for if you're doing this alone and getting minimum support from other organizations?
It's a people-oriented project, so whether we receive funding or we don't, the project will keep on going. We don't receive much funding from the government, but we at times we receive funding from the international organization. And those funding sources are our hope, so we will still continue to receive some funding, and then we'll try to expand our mission. I've been raising this concern over many times in the media, both social media and mainstream media. The government, like provincial government and our district development authority, they are well aware of what we are doing. They should be supporting us because we are taking initiative and we are trying to support the very people that our government should support. But they are very stubborn people. They are not people-oriented people. Officers who are occupying the government offices, so they are not supporting their people. What I am doing is I'm doing for a humanitarian, just for the love of helping my people as long as I am in my community and I exist on this planet. I want to try to help my people with what I can do.
And that was Tony Sulipin on the line from Enga Province, and he was speaking there to reporter Godwin Eke. Pacific Beat. While recently released statistics have prompted some national soul searching in Fiji about how to address the issue of teenage pregnancies. Last month, the Assistant Minister for Health, Benioni Ravunawa, revealed 8 girls under the age of 15 had given birth in the first half of the year. Another 481 slightly older girls, aged between 15 and 19, also gave birth over the same period. Mr. Ravunawa put the figures down to a range of factors, including including access to social media and online pornography and the erosion of traditional and family values. Last week, he proposed a national teenage pregnancy task force to address the issue. Now, a range of community leaders have since commented, with some calling for the issue to be reframed as one of sexual abuse, focusing on the males having sex with underage girls. Among them is Shamina Ali, prominent feminist activist and coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre. She joins us now. That's, I say, good morning, Shamima.
Good morning, Yandra Vinaka.
Thank you so much for joining. I have to ask, were you surprised when these figures were released?
No, not at all, because our organisation, we've been around for about 41 years now, and this issue has been ongoing, and particularly in the last 20 years, and it raises its head, and everyone talks about it, and it goes away again, and then nobody talks about it again. So this time around, there are many more people who are raising their voices.
And Shamima, how do they compare to past figures? Like, is there a notable increase?
I don't think so. I think better numbers are being kept now. Data is much better now. But from what we see, and we go out in the communities a lot, and the women, the young women, the girls and the families who access our services for counseling and so on, it doesn't seem that there is a marked increase.
But this is the thing, though. The statistics seem to have caused a lot of public debate. But has that surprised you then, given it's not really a new problem, right?
It is not a new problem at all. But there is a lot more publicity around it. Many more people are talking about it.
Okay, then.
Which is a good thing.
So what do you think then is responsible for this high rate of teenage pregnancies?
Well, there are many, many factors here. We also have the issue of drugs and so on, and young people partaking in this, and chem sex and things like that. But a lot of, from what we have seen over the years, and from people who access our services for counselling and the pathway to alleviate the suffering of the young people who get pregnant. Child rape seems to be one of the major causes, because there is such a conspiracy of silence because of who are the perpetrators, mostly, that the people have not talked about it, and this is the first time that that we are now we have talked about it, but other people haven't. But other people have joined it and realized that a lot of it is within the homes and so on, where girls are impregnated. Mm-hmm. And then there are also issues of, as I said, the drugs, the lack of realistic kind of sexual rights-based sexual education on sexuality in schools. That's still a debate going on, whether it should be made compulsory or not. And there is very little information from young people on reproductive rights, on sexual and reproductive rights, sexuality, and so on.
Mm. Well, Assistant Minister to Health, Mr. Ramanama, blamed social media, even online pornography, and of course the erosion of traditional and family values. Do you actually agree with this or his assessment?
Well, I would agree to a certain extent, particularly pornography, where young people, because we do know we have been called out to schools, primary schools and so on, whereby the teachers and the school authorities are quite shocked at the amount of sexual behavior at writings, drawings in their toilets, in their classroom desks, and so on, and pictures being passed around, and so on, that is now present in schools, and the fact that people are realizing that that young people are very sexually active. So I guess some of it can fall on pornography, the watching of pornography, wanting to experiment and so on. But I wouldn't say that most of it comes from there, because this has been with us long before smartphones came in.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the question, Shamima. When a girl becomes pregnant and goes and presents at a medical facility, do you know if police or any other authority investigates how it actually happened, to determine if she is a victim of sexual abuse?
Well, that's the problem. We have the law says through the Child Welfare Act that once a child reports a pregnancy or parents report a pregnancy of an underage child, which is under 18, responsibility is of the the duty bearer, health people, to involve social welfare and then the police and so on. There is a referral pathway actually that was developed within the health services for this. And police, of course, if it's a criminal offense, they have to involve social welfare and they have to recognize it as a sexual offense and so on. But it doesn't happen. It's all good on paper, but it doesn't happen. And also we must remember there's a huge conspiracy of silence when most of these people who are, older men who are having sex with underage girls are family members or people very close to the family or known within the community, people that are in trusted positions. So there is this sense of protecting the perpetrator and blaming the child, blaming the person who gets pregnant, their promiscuity and things like that. So we have that issue, and our police force is very famous for that. It's quite infamous, I should say, for that. So while there is a referral pathway that is not followed through, we have children who have had a girl child, who has gotten pregnant, who have gotten pregnant over the years. And I can tell you, we are still dealing with cases where the child that was born is 3 years old, 2 years old, 4 years old, and ready to go to school even, because the process takes so long once it goes to the police. But basically, to answer your question, health people do not follow the referral pathway. A small percentage would, but most of them do not. And that's why, because of the hidden nature of this, the nature of this whole thing where girls are getting pregnant, people don't worry about, don't pay much attention to it.
And the other thing is, among those who've, called for tougher action against the males responsible is the chair of the Great Council of Chiefs, Ratu Viriame Sirivankula, who's said the use of traditional reconciliation ceremonies to resolve cases of sexual abuse must stop. I mean, yeah, how big of an issue is that?
It's a huge issue, and thank God, and congratulations to the, we commend the Great Council of Chiefs, because that's where these voices should be coming from. The strong voice should be coming from, and it is coming through. And I think people will. We have been saying that for ages. This is very common, and it continues till this day. We had lobbied hard enough, advocated hard enough over the years to have it no longer being used in court, the mbulumbulu we call it, the traditional saying sorry and things like that, asking for forgiveness and so on. But it does go through. We have even had reports of, police officers trying to reconcile through this, encouraging the perpetrator or perpetrators to encourage in rape cases and so on. So it is, and, this is a very strong voice that has come through. And hopefully people will, heed that. And particularly in the communities, in the rural communities where, there is not much access to education of this nature and so on.
Shamim, I want to go back a little bit because, you spoke about a lack of sexual literacy among young people earlier. Like, do you think this is feeding into the HIV crisis currently unfolding?
Oh, yes, definitely. Children, young people who have this STIs and HIV AIDS and so on over the years, and people don't know, one is we talk about these things. One is we say we must prevent HIV AIDS and so on, must prevent unwanted pregnancies, particularly of young people and so on. But there is nothing available. People are not encouraged to access. If you say use a condom, then we are encouraging sexual activity. That is how people who say use a condom and so on. So those things aren't available. And if a young person goes and tries to access these things, they're looked at in a funny way. They're sort of bad people, bad boys, bad girls. But also, we have had places where young women would go to access, birth control pills, some kind of contraception and so on, and where You know, people know their parents and say, well, tell your parents, what are you doing, you know, trying to get this stuff and so on. You're promiscuous and so on. So young people are hesitant to access this. They're not readily available. We are not talking openly about these things, and we need to do that. The education system has failed young people over and over again, you know, in providing the kind of education around sexuality, rights-based, respectful behavior, relationships, and so on.
Mm.
So, and that continues because also there are parents, it's an optional thing where parents decide whether their children will get this education or not. In a lot of cases, they decide not to.
Mm. Well, so when it all comes down to it, Shamima, with the work that you do, the sector that you're part of, you know, being able to help women who have gone through these experiences, what then do you think can be done to reduce the number of teenage pregnancies?
Look, we need to do thorough research around this because we are talking from, you know, this is the first time that we've seen the kind of data that has come through. And we need to do a lot more of this. We need to see, because I think the systems are in place, but we are not putting that into use. We are not using and implementing them the way they should be. So we should look at where the gaps are, where we fall short, what do we do, what does the law say. We have to look at all these things. If there is a task force, we welcome it, but the right people should be on it, and we should do that. And also, we really have to look at men's behavior towards young women, towards all women. We have high rates of violence against women in our country, and some of the other Pacific and other Pacific countries. So we have to look at that. We have to take that into account, and we have to look at it through the rights-based lens and so on. Family values are taught everywhere, you know, everywhere. But people are not listening because I don't think we have effective means to do this. I think we should do that. Our police should be coming, you know, into the picture also. Well-trained police officers, well-trained welfare officers, child welfare officers, and so on. So it's a whole lot of it's all of society, including government, you know, taking the lead on this that we'll get. And our faith-based organizations, they have a big role to play in this. And I'm not saying religious teachings, but effective religious teaching that talks about rights, respectful behavior, equality, and so on. I mean, they play a very important role. And also, you know, we have to go back. I know people are talking about culture. We are forgetting. No, there were good things in our culture, pre-colonial colonization, pre-colonial times. So we have to go back into that, you know, dig into that and look at what was good, what protected our girls, what prevented this, you know, this kind of thing, what happened when these things happened. So there's a whole lot of work that needs to be done, but we need to sit at the table together and have various sectors talking about these things and, you know, and have the right people in the right place to be able to do this.
Well, thank you for that. It is definitely an important talanoa, an important conversation we are having this morning. So,
can I just talk about something else? The taboos around sexual talk.
Yeah.
You know, the taboos around it. We have to address that because
have to get to that, Shamima. Apologies, but our show is about to close up there. But we do appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Thank you very much.
That is Shamima Ali, prominent feminist activist and coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Inzane Rugby League on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by ABC Sport commentator Zane Bojack. Inzane Rugby League is a weekly look at the lighter side of rugby league, featuring game insights, latest news and interviews with rugby league legends and from around the edges. So close to the action, you can almost taste the turf. Inzane Rugby League, Tuesday nights at 6 PM PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Now, remember, if you need to find any of our top stories, just type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can always hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daly. So until next time, o tō ao whātou. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.